Welcome back to Money Mania, where we're talking tax season and what to do with that refund. If you really want your tax refund to have a positive impact, I'm bullish on Ohio's 529 plan. I always say, invest in something you love. Well, there's nothing we love more than our kids. So invest in their future and let your tax refund help. For as little as $25, you can get started today at collegeadvantage.com.
Hey, good morning. It is Saturday, April the 1st. I'm Ali Velshi. This week marked another inflection point for the state of our democracy. Donald Trump, the rookie politician who somehow made it into the White House with zero political experience, only to be disgraced as the first president to be impeached twice while in office, is now the first current or former president of the United States to be criminally indicted in history. NBC News has learned that his indictment includes about 30 charges related to document fraud. Those are classified as misdemeanors. And the Associated Press is reporting that, according to its sources, Trump is also facing at least one felony charge stemming from the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's investigation of the former president's role in the hush money payments made to the former adult film star Stormy Daniels, with whom he allegedly had an affair. Donald Trump denies there was an affair, but in a new interview with the London-based Times Radio that aired yesterday, Daniels said she's not afraid. She even hopes to be called to testify against Trump. Trump's indictment is expected to remain sealed until Tuesday afternoon, when he's scheduled to turn himself in to be formally arraigned at a Manhattan courthouse. While there, he will be fingerprinted, processed, and have the charges read to him by Judge Juan Merchan, who will officially oversee the case. Coincidentally, he's the same judge who presided over the Trump Organization's criminal tax fraud trial late last year. That resulted in the company being fined the maximum penalty of $1.6 million. Now, none of that, the unsealing of the indictment, the formal arraignment, and all of the logistics that go along with it, none of that has happened yet. But Trump and many of his allies have already begun criticizing and accusing the justice system of being corrupt and biased against him. Donald Trump, like anyone accused of a crime in the United States, is presumed innocent until proven guilty. He's entitled to his day in court in order to defend himself. But his focus at the moment does not seem to be his defense. It seems to be on delegitimizing the justice system altogether. He seems to have the full-throated support of the Republican Party with him, the vast majority of elected members of which have already come to Trump's defense, including his former Attorney General Bill Barr, who echoed some of Trump's talking points when asked to comment about the indictment at the National Review Ideas Summit yesterday.
Judging from the news reports, it's the archetypal abuse of the prosecutorial function to engage in a political hit job. And it's a disgrace if it turns out to be what we think it is. Politically, it's going to be damaging, I think, to the Republican Party, simply because I think it's a no-lose situation for the Democrats. And legally, I think it's, from what I understand, a pathetically weak case.
The tone, the tenor, and the substance of much of Trump World's response to his indictment seems focused on undermining the justice system in order to undercut the validity of a possible guilty verdict. And politically, it's a message that has worked for Trump in the past. In fact, he's been fundraising off the news of his indictment, and his campaign says it received more than $4 million in new donations in the first 24 hours after news of the indictment broke. I'm joined by Michael Schur, journalist and former congressional candidate. Michael, I was fascinated when the indictment came out, looking through the quotes, the tweets, the press releases from Republican members of Congress. And with the exception, I still haven't found an exception except for Don Bacon of Nebraska, where someone said, wow, he's going to get his day in court. He's innocent until proven guilty. What an opportunity to clear his name and show that these charges are false. Instead, it was filled with witch hunt, left-wing, radical, socialist, Soros-backed DA Manhattan Bragg language.
Yeah, and it's not surprising. These things and these responses, these tweets, these sort of edicts about the justice system by elected Republicans have probably been written for weeks, Allie. These are things that they were prepared to release. As Donald Trump's poll numbers within the Republican primary have either stayed steady or gone up at least over 10% in one of those polls, you have these members of Congress who are in safe districts who have nothing to lose by supporting and only actually to gain, Allie, by supporting Donald Trump. So you look at a House of Representatives, for example, that is, let's say, 2 to 3% of those seats are ever in play now. It's been so gerrymandered. When you support Donald Trump in your district, you're doing just fine. You're speaking to your audience. I was struck by Bill Barr just now. He's speaking at the National Review. So in essence, he's speaking to his audience, a group of conservatives, and he's defending Donald Trump because that's the thing you do right now, still in the Republican Party, probably to their peril. You look at the Senate, it becomes a little bit different because they're a little more careful. They're not in these gerrymandered districts. They're in bigger states. So the reaction, while still adhering to Trump, is in unison, probably because it's been written already and in the books for a while.
Michael, let me ask you, though, I am worried about something else. On one hand, the motivation for most of these Republicans may be don't cross Donald Trump right now. If he gets convicted and goes to jail, you can cross him then, maybe. But I'm more worried about the fact that this is reminiscent of the days before the election or the months before the election when Donald Trump would warn people that the election was going to be corrupted, so he may not have to accept the result of it. Obviously, he can't not accept the result if there is a guilty verdict. But his followers cannot accept that.
No, that's true. And there's a delegitimization of the process that is one of the fruits of the Trump administration, one of the fruits of this looking at American politics as sort of a joke, and we're going to come in and we're going to break it down. Calling it the swamp from the beginning was what got him to the White House, in essence. And when he comes in there, sort of taking it apart to begin with, his followers like that. The problem is his followers are a smaller group than they used to be, and they're finding that these things aren't working as well. If you spend 4 years delegitimizing congressional investigations, for example, then you try and have your own, people aren't paying attention. Look at what the oversight committees in the House are doing right now. They're not paying such close attention to that because these are the same people that said House hearings don't matter. Oversight doesn't matter. And I think you're going to see that a little bit with these indictments. Sure, you're going to, you know, New York doesn't release mugshots, but somehow that mugshot's going to be released, I would guess. You're going to see him sort of, lionized by people in the Republican Party after this. But I think that the group of people that adhere to what Donald Trump says and does, I think that's a shrinking group. And I think that's what's going to, what you're going to see come out. I mean, Don Bacon is a good example of that.
The thing that I found interesting was Kevin McCarthy, again, without seeing the indictment, without hearing the case, has decided that Congress will hold the Manhattan DA accountable for what he calls his unprecedented abuse of power. Now, I think that's weird that Congress would do that with a DA before hearing the case. I think it's weird that they would be talking that way about an elected DA without an actual allegation that has gone through some sort of process. But what's more interesting about this whole thing is the degree to which they don't have any power to do that. That you'd have to have all of Congress together to do something about the Manhattan DA.
Yeah, this is just fodder for the newspaper. And I think in many of these cases, this is directed at one person picking up the newspaper at Mar-a-Lago, reading through it and seeing the people that are supporting him and being comfortable with the fact that, OK, Donald Trump saw that I came out and said we should investigate. This isn't about whether or not it can be done. People don't look into that who are following Donald Trump and were supporting Donald Trump. I would imagine Donald Trump doesn't look into it. But I do think that this is about having him know that we have your back. And until that breaks, and until, you know, I think we're going to obviously see more indictments and New York will become a smaller case. But until that happens, I would imagine this is going to be the sort of unison song of members of the House. And he's the leader of the House.
Michael, I don't know where you are, but whenever I talk to you, you're in California and it's very early in the morning. So I appreciate you joining us as always. My old friend Michael Schur is an independent journalist and former congressional candidate. Joining me now is June Kim, former acting U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. Also with us, Christy Greenberg, who served for over a decade in the office of the U.S. attorney for the SDNY, most recently as deputy chief of the criminal division. Good to see both of you. Thank you for being with us.
Sure. Good morning.
You've both been involved in extremely high profile cases. June, you were with in in the Governor Cuomo case, Christie with Firefest's Billy McFarland. Talk to me, please, about the notoriety here. What effect does the fact that this is a, for better or for worse, celebrity person being indicted?
I mean, it shouldn't make a difference in the way you approach the case. What you do is make sure that everything is done by the book.
Right, because there'll be a microscope on it.
There'll be a microscope. That should be done with every case, big or small. But where cases that will get media attention, and this is, you know, the case that will get the most attention, as far as we remember, you're going to make sure all their I's dotted and all the T's are crossed.
And you think that's being done? Because, boy, Alvin Bragg's under a microscope here. He's being accused by everybody of pretty much everything, though no actual accusations, nothing that would go through judicial review.
No, it appears he is following the letter of the law and doing things by the book. His letter response to members of Congress who are seeking to get information about his investigation. I thought that was an incredibly professional letter,
right,
saying you don't have jurisdiction. I am doing the work. My team is doing the work. We have a criminal investigation that we need to maintain and keep secret, and we're not going to allow interference from the politicians, from the media. We are going to just keep our head down and do the work. So,
and in fairness, there's a judge involved here who gets to adjudicate these things, although Donald Trump has already done exactly what you'd expect Donald Trump to do. He's gone to undermine the judge, in this case because it was the judge in the Trump Organization trial whom he says hates him.
Yeah, and judges will approach it the same way. And this, by all accounts, was a professional judge who handled it very professionally the last time around. They're also used to the kind of attacks, unfortunately, that he's seeing. And they're also used to making sure that the high profile and bigger cases are handled especially well.
Does this judge have to do anything by virtue of the fact that he oversaw a case in which Trump's company as defendant was unsuccessful?
Well, he's certainly familiar with the players involved, right? He's the person who sentenced Alan Weisselberg in connection with that case. So he has familiarity with the organization, but really the judge is going to be looking at the evidence in this particular case and evaluating that evidence and whether it, you know, comports with the law.
There may be a role for Alan Weisselberg in this trial as the money guy. Does the fact that that judge convicted Weisselberg or was in charge of the proceeding that convicted Weisselberg relevant here?
It's relevant in the sense that there's a reason it's going to that judge. It's because it's a related case. But that's not uncommon for a judge to know some of the underlying facts because of an existing case. So it's not relevant in the sense that it's inappropriate in any way. It's actually quite common for a judge to have some knowledge about the case because they handle the related one.
One of our producers, Lisa Rubin, who practices law, made an observation the other day that Trump is now talking about this prosecution as election interference. Now, on the face of it, it's not. From a legal perspective, it's not. But as we were just discussing with Michael Schur, that may be a political thing that is meant to make people see the outcome of this trial as illegitimate no matter what.
Look, this investigation has been pending for quite some time. It was pending well before he announced his candidacy. I think he's going to have a real uphill battle in trying to say that this was in any way politically motivated or that it's being brought to bring down his candidacy.
I mean, there is a practice and policy within the Department of Justice, at least, and the U.S. Attorney's Office, is that if you are handling a case or an investigation that could impact an upcoming election, you need to do it. You need to take action sufficiently in advance of an election and not do anything in the immediate lead up because you don't want to impact elections. And we're, you know, although, you know, our federal election cycle runs for so long, but we're still quite a bit of ways from the.
Do you have some level
election
of confidence, though, given how long these trials take, that this won't bleed into something that's too close to an election?
I think it will. Yeah. But, I mean, unfortunately, because of how long these election cycles run and how long cases and trials go, criminal cases can go before they go to trial.
Right.
It's unfortunately probably going to run into it Unless
yeah, I mean, look,
in
most,
sign, which is not
most electoral democracies, the election period is prescribed. So you know the date by which you have to be done because there's an election period. This is America. We're in an election period all the time. Stay right here because I want to just take a break and come back and continue this conversation. Also coming up, we'll talk to someone who's known and written about Donald Trump for 35 years. Plus, we're going to talk to experts on how the news of Donald Trump's indictment is being treated by conspiracy theorists and followers of the former president. Also, I'll talk about what this all means for the current and future state of American democracy with the man who helped save democracy back in 2020, Judge Michael Luttig.
Welcome back to Money Mania, where we're talking tax season and what to do with that refund. If you really want your tax refund to have a positive impact, I'm bullish on Ohio's 529 plan. I always say, invest in something you love. Well, there's nothing we love more than our kids. So invest in their future and let your tax refund help. For as little as $25, you can get started today at collegeadvantage.com.
All right, back with me, June Kim, who served as the acting United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York from March 2017 to January 2018. Christy Greenberg, who served as Deputy Chief of the Criminal Division at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. Thanks for staying with me. Christy, let me ask you what you've gleaned in the last, 24, 48 hours about the charges and what's likely to happen, because it seems like there are multiple charges and many or most of them are misdemeanors, but there may be a felony charge involved here somewhere.
Right. So there's been reporting that there are anywhere from 24 to 30 counts in the indictment. So what I would expect one of those counts to be a conspiracy count. That really allows the prosecutor to tell the story, to be able to say, here's what the criminal scheme was, and here's how Donald Trump fit into that. He is the person directing others to engage in criminal conduct. Also allows them, they don't have to set out the motive, but here would be a way for them to set forth who was the one who was getting the benefit from all of this. And that was Donald Trump to win the election. It also allows them to set forth facts where they can go towards proving the intent to defraud. And if it's a felony, you also need to show an intent to further or conceal another crime. So setting this forth as a conspiracy allows them to set the stage and really do that and provide more information. Also expect that there would be substantive counts. So you could charge each falsified business record as its own count. So you have the checks from Donald Trump to Michael Cohen. Those could be, each check could be its own count. You also have the corresponding entries in the Trump Organization business records, where they are listed as legal expenses, which, of course, that's false, and we know they weren't. Each of those entries could also be its own falsified business record count. So again, those would be misdemeanor counts unless you are able to connect it to this furtherance or concealing of another crime. What could those be? That's the $64,000 question. We don't know. Will it be federal? Will it be state? There's reporting that it could be campaign finance law, could be election law, could be tax law. You know, we just don't have the visibility to know what that will look like.
Which may make this judge who has been put in charge of this relevant, because this idea of different kinds of entries in your books or keeping two kinds of books, that's something that has been pursued by the courts with respect to the Trump Organization and is still being pursued by the New York Attorney General, Letitia James. So these things are connected. The whole story of how the Trump Organization and Trump and Cohen and Weisselberg and everybody operated might be relevant to telling the story.
Yeah, I mean, the judge, I think, is going to be very relevant going forward. I think you're going to see this played out in two stages, right? He's going to show up for his arraignment, and then there's going to be a schedule set. And the schedule is going to first involve legal briefing and motions, and that's when the judge is going to be very important. Well, I'm sure that there will be any number of motions to dismiss the indictment for any number of reasons, to move venue, and that motion, those motions are going to be decided by the judge before it gets to a jury. And so the judge is going to play a very significant role in saying as a legal matter, these charges are appropriate, because there's been a lot of talk about, you know, it's all speculation.
Right.
But talk about this being an unprecedented fact pattern. But those things will be litigated in court as a legal matter. The judge will decide that. And then what the indictment and the charges that survive those attacks will go to a jury And so I think you're right to note that this judge is going to play a big role.
Right, to the extent that he doesn't have to keep on asking people, wait, explain that to me, because this is complicated. I guess the trick is how you make this really easy for a jury, because these white collar cases tend to be a little bit hard sometimes for folks to understand. Thanks again to both of you for being here. We always appreciate it. We're going to need you a lot in the near future. June Kim and Christy Greenberg. NBC has learned that Donald Trump is headed to New York City on Monday night, arriving at the courthouse around 1 p.m. Tuesday before heading back to the airport to fly to Florida. Up next, we're going to try to make sense of what is motivating Trump right now with someone who has known and reported on the former president for more than three decades. Soon after Donald Trump learned on Thursday that the Manhattan grand jury voted to indict, he fired off a series of posts on his social media platform, Truth Social, characterizing the indictment as an act of, quote, political persecution. He also described the indictment as a continuing attack on our once free and fair elections, part of a larger pattern of Trump depicting his personal woes as a collective attack against his MAGA base. Now, according to the New York Times, Trump and his team were blindsided by the indictment, which they were not expecting to come down until late April. And while Trump's lawyer, Joe Tacopina, said that the former president was shocked, he also said Trump is, quote, ready to fight. Joining me now is David K. Johnson. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. He's the co-founder of DCReport.org. David's been covering Donald Trump for some 35 years. He's written multiple books about Trump, including The Big Cheat, How Donald Trump Fleeced America and Enriched Himself and His Family. David, good to see you again. Thank you. You and I were together the night that this all happened. Has anything that has developed that night or since surprised you, given how much you know about how Donald Trump reacts to these things?
No, Donald's following his standard playbook. The only unusual development was George Soros stepping out and saying, I never gave a dime to Alvin Bragg and I've never met the man. But Trump people continue to push that false line.
Let's talk about that. There is a lot of benefit in invoking Soros's name because it is a dog whistle. To some people, they'll say, oh, it's a rich guy donating to Alvin Bragg. But let's you and I be plain here. This is a Jewish puppet master controlling a black man prosecutor.
That's exactly the line that Donald is selling. And it fits with Donald's entire life. His father saw to it in the thousands of apartments that the Trump family owned, built with taxpayer subsidies in Brooklyn and Queens, that black people and Puerto Ricans were steered to certain buildings and other buildings were kept entirely white. And Donald's whole life is built around this. In 1927, his father, Fred, who was a monstrous father, absolutely cruel and mean, and who taught his sons that all that mattered was winning, by which he meant getting money. He was arrested during a pitched battle between about 1,000 KKK members and 100 New York City police. His address was published in eight newspapers, but Donald insists, no, that wasn't my father, that was somebody else.
That's unbelievable. Let's talk a little bit about something you wrote in the Daily Beast about what to expect next from Trump, because this is important to people as he tries to rally his supporters. Trump's support among Republicans will rise, at least for a while. Trump will surrender to avoid the risk of pre-trial detention and be fingerprinted, mugshotted, and perhaps put in handcuffs while his Secret Service detail watches. Trump will continue riling up the most deranged and fanatical MAGA elements for the final battle to put him back in the White House. Tell me a little about that last sentence, to put him back in the White House. Why do you think anything Donald Trump says here results in that end?
Oh, Donald believes, first of all, that he should be president. There is no one else qualified to do so. He really believes that. He believes he is the person in the whole world. He should probably run the whole world. And he's running again because he believes he will get back in the White House. Now, I just did a piece at DC Report showing he had a very small crowd at Waco, something every journalist there except one missed entirely. And even the one who did it only did it generally. But Donald believes he deserves to be president. He's entitled to be president. And furthermore, he should be president for life. And then as he also believes as president, he should be able to do anything he wants. So however he were to gain power, that's fine with Donald. He doesn't have any issue about that. The problem for him is that he doesn't recognize is that his support is shriveling.
Let's talk about his support. You and I talked about this on Thursday, but I want to read this out to the viewer. Can Donald Trump repeat his success in persuading thousands of his followers to storm the Capitol? Will masses of MAGAs fill the streets in New York and other cities, break into more government buildings, and use force to prevent any prosecutions of their hero? I think not. And such a failure would show that his once powerful hold on the disaffected has waned, relentlessly shriveling toward impotence. And interestingly enough, the Manhattan Police, New York Police Department, they were all told to show up in uniform on Friday morning to be ready for anything. There was no thing. There's not appear to be any thing. That's not to say there may not be random acts of violence across the United States. What was surprising is before you and I were on air together on Thursday night, Tucker Carlson had said on his show in response to a guest saying that Republicans should be very worried. He said, this isn't the time for you to be giving up your AR-15s. So I am worried that there's some effort to fuel armed resistance or violent resistance.
There will be blood. There are going to be people who believe Donald Trump's nonsense and think he's a demigod or a god, and they're going to commit some violent acts. But you're not going to see mass insurrection the way we did on January 6th. There's lots of study that's been done that I've read on revolutions. Revolutions are led by highly educated people. Fidel Castro was a lawyer. And by young men who conclude that the known future is so horrible, they will go with an unknown future. And that's not the condition in America. The people who stormed the Capitol were in their late 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. They were not young men. And now that they've seen how seriously those crimes are being prosecuted, it's highly unlikely Trump can get people to replicate that kind of behavior. On the other hand, look at the Republican leaders who are fomenting an anti-law and order message, who are attacking the legitimacy of a routine criminal investigation that's being carried out by prosecutors, detectives, and a grand jury. This is a stunning and important development, this abandonment of the rule of law by people who should know better. Kevin McCarthy, our timid speaker, Senator Graham from South Carolina, who, 8 years ago was telling us Donald Trump is a kook, yep. Which he is.
David, good to see you as always. Thank you, my friend. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative journalist and the author of The Big Cheat, How Donald Trump Fleeced America and Enriched Himself and His Family. All right. Moments ago, NBC News captured video of Trump's motorcade leaving Mar-a-Lago in Florida. A short time later, he arrived at another one of his properties, Trump International Golf Course in West Palm Beach, where I guess he's out for a day on the links. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Money Mania, where we're talking tax season. And what to do with that refund? If you really want your tax refund to have a positive impact, I'm bullish on Ohio's 529 plan. I always say, invest in something you love. Well, there's nothing we love more than our kids. So invest in their future and let your tax refund help. For as little as $25, you can get started today at collegeadvantage.com.
Deadly tornado swept through the South and Midwest last night, leaving at least 7 people dead and dozens more injured. Right now, more than 155,000 customers are without power across Illinois, Indiana, and Arkansas, according to PowerOutage.us. Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders says central Arkansas suffered significant damage as video shows downed power lines, toppled trees, and mangled homes. Joining me now is NBC News correspondent Emily Ikeda, who is in Little Rock, Arkansas. Emily, Little Rock was a place that was also hit, which is interesting because it's a place with very solid urban infrastructure, and yet there's a great deal of damage in that city that you're in.
Yeah, absolutely. There is evidence of the sheer force of this storm, Allie, just about everywhere you turn in this part of Little Rock. Behind me, that is a row of storefronts, all of that completely blown in. And keep in mind, that is where a lot of people ran to take shelter as the tornado just swept through this area. So it's plain to see where some of the injuries stemmed from. People describe, compare the force of this storm, like with the force that it could just lift up and toss cars like toys. And that's what you're seeing right here. This car just completely flipped over onto this other car. Allie, actually, when this tornado was coming through here, our crew was just about 10 minutes away from this point, matter of minutes away. So we heard those tornadoes tornado sirens blaring throughout the afternoon. This area saw back-to-back tornado warnings. Here in Pulaski County, officials are reporting more than 50 people were hospitalized since the storm. That number is anticipated to continue to rise as search and rescue efforts continue this morning. One person tragically killed in this area. If you look east closer to Wynn, Arkansas, some even more dramatic pictures there. Major roadways still closed. Neighborhoods just completely leveled. The governor of Arkansas reporting two people were killed there. She has declared a state of emergency. Again, those search and rescue missions continuing to play out throughout the day. The other thing happening at the moment, you'll hear kind of the construction vehicles, the chainsaws, the cleanup efforts starting to get underway. And a big one, as you can see from behind me, Allie.
Emily, thank you for your reporting. NBC's Emily Ikeda in Little Rock, Arkansas. Still ahead, the conspiracy theories surrounding former President Trump's indictment aren't just flat out false. They're full of anti-Semitic and racist dog whistles.
Welcome back to Money Mania, where we're talking tax season and what to do with that refund. If you really want your tax refund to have a positive impact, I'm bullish on Ohio's 529 plan. I always say, invest in something you love. Well, there's nothing we love more than our kids. So invest in their future and let your tax refund help. For as little as $25, you can get started today at collegeadvantage.com.
The outrage from Trump supporters and the right wing has been swift and fierce since news of the former president's indictment first broke on Thursday night. Much of the backlash has been aimed directly at the man who is the face of this prosecution, the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg. Trump and his acolytes in the media and in Congress were targeting Bragg specifically even before the indictment, from the time that Trump took to social media claiming his arrest was imminent. They've name-checked Bragg repeatedly, calling the charges in the indictment baseless, which, remember, no one has seen yet, accusing Bragg of political prosecution and undermining the entire justice system. I want to draw your attention to one particularly dangerous trope that has emerged from the right-wing attacks against Bragg. If you've been following the Republican outrage machine, including many elected Republicans, you've probably already heard about the conspiracy theory that Bragg was handpicked and funded by the Jewish billionaire George Soros. In fact, Bragg was elected by voters in New York County in 2021, and it's well documented that Soros never gave any money directly to Bragg. He donated to a political action committee that supported progressive candidates who were seeking to be prosecutors, and that group included Bragg. But that is too nuanced for the folks who are trying to stoke fear and doubt in our judicial system. It's not an accident that the right wing is trying to tie Alvin Bragg to George Soros specifically. The conservatives' use of George Soros as a boogeyman is steeped in racist conspiracy tropes, meant to stoke fear among white conservatives that rich Jewish overlords secretly control things behind the scenes. The banks, the media, Hollywood, and now, in fact, the courts. These racist, deplorable conspiracy theories have a long history in this country and around the world, but it's been remarkable to watch how quickly this latest racist conspiracy theory, attempting to tie George Soros to Alvin Bragg and Trump's prosecution, has taken over the narrative on the right. It's being spread in conservative media, and even, as I mentioned, by prominent members of the GOP, like Congressman Paul Gosar, Ronnie Jackson, Senators Marsha Blackburn, Ron Johnson, Rick Scott, the Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. These are conspiracies which were once fringe, and unfortunately now they're very mainstream. Joining me now is Brandi Zadrozny, a senior reporter for NBC News who covers disinformation, extremism, and the internet, and NBC's Vaughn Hilliard down in Palm Beach, Florida, near Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. Good to see both of you. Thank you for being with us. Brandi, let me start with you, because this isn't, you often sort of, as I say, troll the underbelly of the internet to find these unusual conspiracy theories with which most of us never confront. But this one's actually out there. The Soros-picked, Soros-backed Alvin Bragg is sort of covering two racist things in one.
Yeah. So, you know, like you said, Allie, George Soros, or the invocation of him, is just a really tried and true tactic of, you know, people put the blame on him for everything under the sun, really. And it does tap into that you know, anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that Jewish people are controlling the world. A theory that, you know, for what it's worth, Marjorie Taylor Greene spread on her Facebook page and in videos for a blog that she wrote on, you know, and I just did a little like look back and I actually just wanted to see like what people have blamed Soros for recently. And, you know, I found examples from the migrant caravan that was the boogeyman in 2018. He was blamed for that. He was blamed for the gun protests that high school students were engaging in after their schools were shot up in Florida. Rudy Giuliani blamed Soros for not being able to get out of Ukraine in 2019. And Trump said that Soros was behind the anti-Kavanaugh nomination to the Supreme Court. And so another interesting thing is I worked for Fox News in the early aughts, and I still remember that Glenn Beck had a program and he would bring out this big blackboard and he would have these like crazy conspiracy theories spun up. And at the top of the pyramid always was George Soros. He actually had a special called George Soros, the Puppet Master, which again is this anti-Semitic trope. So you're right, it's not new, but it does have real consequences. This kind of language, it vilifies the Jewish community. We have seen direct targeted threats towards the Jewish community. In 2018 or 2019, we had a guy send pipe bombs to news organizations and George Soros. You know, this kind of rhetoric can end in violence.
Vaughn, when you and I were together on Thursday night, we were reminiscing in between commercial breaks about some of the trips you've taken where you're out there talking on a very regular basis over the last few years to Trump supporters. And you were talking about the degree to which even recently last weekend in Waco, Texas, this conspiracy theory stuff is embraced. This idea that Donald Trump is avenger and justice and retribution. Some of these followers really believe there's some kind of a war or some kind of a thing coming from the establishment, and Donald Trump is their warrior who will stand between the government and them.
Right, and it's because the right-wing elements of the internet are full with these conspiracy theories, but it's also legitimized in their eyes by the right-wing outlets that they watch, not only Fox News, but also OAN, Newsmax, Right Side Broadcasting, and then they are propagated by the leader, Donald Trump here. And not only do we hear these in Waco, but, you know, I think Brandy brought up the good point. I remember back in 2018 and those weeks before the 2018 midterm elections, it was the idea of the caravan and that George Soros was somehow behind the funding of this caravan to take over as part of the great replacement theory. All of these conspiracies are intertwined with one another. And the latest attack that he is on is also against the judge who has been placed in charge of overseeing his case here, making direct attacks, suggesting that this judge is a hater who hates Trump and that this is an unfair trial. And it's hard not to go back to 2016. And we remember Judge Curiel, who was the one, the federal district judge in the Southern District of California, who was tasked with overseeing the Trump University fraud case. And at the time, Trump had suggested that, again, much like we're hearing the attacks against this judge in New York, that he was a hater of Trump. He had mentioned his Mexican descent, and as Donald Trump was calling for the building of the wall. And these are messages that we hear from voters constantly, that he can't get a fair shake. These judges are not fair. But time and again, ultimately in that Trump University case, Donald Trump settled for $25 million. He paid out $25 million to former students. And you saw the attacks against the likes of Robert Mueller. And it wasn't until after the Mueller report came out in which he declared that he was vindicated. So he goes on the attack on the front end, spreads the conspiracy theories among his millions of supporters to delegitimize if he were to be found guilty or were be found wrongdoing. To delegitimize any of those findings or potential convictions in their eyes for later down the road, Ali.
All right, both of you stand by. We're going to take a break. We're going to continue this on the other side. Brandi Zadrozny and Vaughn Hilliard. We'll be right back. Back with me, Brandi Zadrozny, a senior reporter for NBC News who covers disinformation, extremism, and the internet. NBC's Vaughn Hilliard in Palm Beach, Florida, near Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. Brandi, Donald Trump, I guess, timed his return to Facebook along with this indictment. He has posted, I think, a lot of misinformation there, but he's had more than 300,000 last time we checked, which might have been a few hours ago, interactions on Facebook. This is accelerating. The disinformation, the misinformation is accelerating as it relates to Donald Trump.
Well, it always does. but the point is that, like, he now has these channels back. And so the last time that we saw him with these channels, we know what he did with them. He used them to organize and incite a insurrection at the Capitol that was very violent and led to many of his supporters sitting in a prison right now. And so it's really, we don't know how he's going to use these tools and these platforms. And moreover, we don't know what tools or safeguards the platforms have in place so that their platforms won't be used again in this manner. It really is sort of a wait and see situation. And that's just what we have to do.
Vaughn, one of the things you and I were talking about the other night was preparations for violence. There hasn't seemed to have been any. Certainly no organized protests at the morning, although Ben Collins did file a piece last night that suggests there are some efforts to organize protests. You're there in Florida. There were some random people standing on the bridge the other night. What's going on in terms of preparations for protests as Donald Trump gets ready to leave there and be arrested?
Right. So far, we've only seen a couple dozen folks over the course of the last days outside of Mar-a-Lago. They, frankly, haven't seemed like that great of a threat. They tell us that they're there more to party and rally around him rather than to protest, per se. But I think the concern is obviously these one-off potential attacks here. Individuals who are inspired by Donald Trump, who has even used before the indictment the suggestion that there could be, quote, potential death and destruction, that there, if he were to be charged, years of turmoil, chaos, and hatred. Again, all of those in his own words before the indictment here. We have seen a history of individuals that have gone on the attack. You have the likes of the man who went and attacked the FBI field office in Ohio last August after the search warrant was executed here at Mar-a-Lago. You had then last November, the man who broke into the home of the Pelosi's and attacked Mr. Pelosi with a hammer. There is clearly individuals who have shown a willingness to act. There are hundreds of threats, according to the district attorney's office, that have already come into Alvin Bragg's office. It's important to note the juxtaposition in lower Manhattan. You have the Manhattan district attorney's office literally across the street from the criminal court building where we anticipate the former president to go for his arraignment here. You know, for Donald Trump, this is a lot coming to a head, and he has shown the need to try to aggravate his base here and suggest that this is the end, that they cannot take it anymore. Just late last night, he had suggested how much more are patriots supposed to take. Of course, that is a clear suggestion that the way that things are currently happening cannot keep on. Of course, last year also, Ali, it was him, the former president, who suggested there should be a termination and suspension of the rules within the Constitution. I think that we're going into uncharted territory here right now.
Thanks to both of you. We'll continue to follow this closely with you. NBC's Brandi Zadrozny covering extremism and misinformation. NBC's Vaughn Hilliard near Mar-a-Lago. All right, we've got much more coming up on Velshi. What it means that Donald Trump is trying to convince the electorate that the fact that he's being prosecuted constitutes election interference. And an update on the widespread damage across southern and midwestern states following yet another wave of deadly tornadoes overnight. Another hour of Velshi begins right now. Good morning. It's Saturday, April the 1st. It's 10 a.m. in the east, 7 a.m. in the west. I'm Ali Velshi. This week marked another inflection point for the state of our democracy. Donald Trump, the rookie politician who somehow made it into the White House with zero political experience, only to be disgraced as the first president to be impeached twice while in office, is now the first current or former president to be criminally indicted in U.S. history. NBC News has learned that his indictment includes about 30 charges related to document fraud classified as misdemeanors. The Associated Press is reporting that, according to its sources, Trump is also facing at least one felony charge stemming from the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's investigation of the former president's role in the hush money payment made to the former adult film actress Stormy Daniels, with whom he allegedly had an affair. Donald Trump does deny that he had that affair. But in a new interview with the London-based Times Radio that aired yesterday, Daniels said she's not afraid and she even hopes to be called to testify against Trump. Trump's indictment is expected to remain sealed until Tuesday afternoon, when he is scheduled to turn himself in to be formally arraigned at a Manhattan courthouse. While there, he will be fingerprinted, processed, and have charges read to him. Judge Juan Marchand, who will oversee the case, coincidentally the same judge who presided over the Trump Organization's criminal tax fraud trial late last year that resulted in the company being fined the maximum penalty of $1.6 million. None of that, the unsealing of the indictment, the formal arraignment, and all of the logistics that go with it, none of that has happened yet. But Trump and many of his allies have already begun criticizing and accusing the justice system of being corrupt and biased against him. Donald Trump, like anyone accused of a crime in the United States, is presumed innocent until proven guilty and until he's also entitled to his day in court in order to defend himself. But his focus at the moment seems to be delegitimizing the justice system altogether. And he seems to have the full-fledged support of the Republican Party, the vast majority of elected members of which have already come to Trump's defense, including those considering running against him as the leader of the party and the 2024 GOP presidential nominee, like his own Vice President Mike Pence.
I think the unprecedented indictment of a former president of the United States for a campaign finance issue is an outrage. And I think it's clear to the overwhelming majority of the American people that this is nothing short of a political prosecution, being affected by a Manhattan DA who literally campaigned on bringing charges against one particular American.
The tone, tenor, and substance of much of Trump World's response to his indictment seems focused on undermining the justice system in order to undercut the validity of a possible guilty verdict. And politically, it's a message that has worked for Trump in the past. Trump, by the way, has been fundraising off the news of his indictment, and his campaign says it has received more than $4 million in new donations in the first 24 hours after news broke of the indictment. Joining me now is NBC News Washington correspondent Yamiche Alcindor. Yamiche, you have been out there talking to people, in addition to the fact that you've got this great deep well of sources. Depending on who you ask, they see this entirely differently. This is a case that a grand jury has evaluated based on the facts, not for guilt or innocence, but just to determine that there is enough to go to trial. But there are a lot of people in America who do not believe that to be true.
That's right. And it's really interesting because the way that Americans see this indictment and former President Trump's legal problems is really influenced by their political affiliation and their political perspective. And that bears out not just in the people that I've been talking to in polling. We see one poll from Quinnipiac just this released in the last week that said that something like 93% of Republicans think that the Manhattan DA's issues and the legal case there, that is politically motivated. And then you have 66% of Democrats who say that's actually motivated by law. And then when I've been talking to people, I have to tell you, when I've been talking to Democrats, Democratic voters here in D.C., one man told me he was ecstatic, that he was having a tough day, but that seeing Trump being indicted made him feel better. He also, though, paused to say this could muddy up the waters for other sorts of legal cases, including, of course, the Georgia DA who's looking into election interference. This could be the special counsel's case when it comes to January 6th. So there are Democrats who are still worried about this case. But overall, you're seeing a Democratic Party and Democratic voters who are embracing this. And then you're seeing Republicans who are just really rushing to his defense. And I think it's fascinating to see not just sort of Trump supporters, but people who could really benefit from just being quiet and seeing how this plays out. You think of someone like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and Mike Pence, who are potential rivals for former President Trump, who are coming out before we know the charges, before we know the details, to say this is a political prosecution. That tells you the grip that former President Trump has on his party. And I should tell you, a whopping 72% of Republicans have told Quinnipiac just in the last week that they think former President Trump had a positive, overall positive impact on the Republican Party, even though he lost the 2020 election, even though the midterms, both in 2022 and 2018, they were problematic. But you see the Republican Party still embracing former President Trump, Ali.
Because everybody likes somebody who energizes the base. And for better or worse, Donald Trump actually does that. But you bring up an interesting point, because I was talking about the reaction in Trump World, which seems to have expanded to pretty much every elected Republican in Congress. But neither Mike Pence nor Ron DeSantis fit into that category. They are not Trump World. They are actually potentially Trump opponents. Mike Pence has made very clear that he thinks Donald Trump put him and his family's life in danger on January 6th. There's no love lost today between Mike Pence and Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump. And yet they, too, have thrown themselves fully into this thing. They haven't said things like, hey, Donald Trump will have a trial. He's presumed innocent until proven guilty. He may walk away and nothing will have happened. They're not saying that. They're talking about an illegitimate prosecution.
Exactly. And it really is fascinating to think that the people who could be running against former President Trump, that they're not waiting back and say, well, let's see how this plays out. You mean, let's think about the person who lives in the house right behind me, who, of course, is President Biden. He's in Wilmington today. But the White House has said, we're not going to comment on an ongoing criminal investigation. It reminds me of the 2020 election where when former President Trump was sort of had a big debacle on his hands when it came to the COVID-19 pandemic. And he's telling people to take Clorox to treat the virus. And he had all these real tough issues. You saw a then candidate Biden really stepping back and letting him muddy the waters. In this case, the people who would be former President Trump's political rivals, of course, Ron DeSantis, Mike Pence, Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, all of these different Republicans, instead of saying, I'm going to step back and sort of be quiet and see how this goes, they're jumping out in front, likely, I guess, because they want to be seen as making sure that they're with the party and with the Republican mm-hmm. Party. But it isn't obviously helping them when it comes to sort of who could beat Donald Trump. And in some ways, it could create a glide path for Trump to win the GOP nomination if everyone's rallying behind him.
Is it just that there's zero currency in being in Trump's way on this one? And it like just either let it burn itself out or he gets convicted or something happens, but there's just no benefit in being in front of this?
When I talk to Republicans, it seems as though that this narrative of a big government that is going after everyday Americans, this narrative that Republicans are somehow sort of conservative victims, that is a narrative that goes far past Donald Trump and that the voters have really embraced this. Also remember, former President Trump is saying, they're not just coming after me. I'm the only thing standing in between you and your political enemies. That's what he's telling Trump supporters and Republicans. So I think that's in some ways what's animating these other Republicans to get on board, because it's not just about Trump's legal problems. They're letting it be this idea that any voter, any American, that they could be subject to the law, which, of course, in some cases, Ali, is true. If you break the law in this country, you will be subject to the same sort of legal consequences that we're seeing play out in the case in the Manhattan DA's case. So there's a little bit of truth to that. But there isn't some grand conspiracy, at least based on my reporting, to go after conservatives. But that is the line that is sort of taking over the Republican Party, which is, I think, why you see these Republican rivals grabbing onto this idea.
Yamiche, good to see you this morning. Thank you for joining us. NBC News Washington correspondent Yamiche Alcindor. With me now, Barbara McQuaid, former United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan and an MSNBC legal analyst. Also joining us, Lisa Rubin, former litigator and also an MSNBC legal analyst who has kept me posted all week. It's because of Lisa I even know what questions to ask. So thanks to both of you. Barbara, I want to ask you a question. Obviously, we have dealt with the idea that there's been a lot of allegations and accusations by Republicans that this is a political prosecution and not and persecution, as Donald Trump says. But tell me about timing, because these cases take a long time. They take months, if not longer than a year. Today, we seem to have some space between us and the next presidential election. But in a year, we won't have much. Does this become more political the longer it takes?
Well, I think, Ellie, people are going to talk about it as if it's political. We've already seen such a deluge of attacks about before people have even seen the charges that this is politically motivated and they don't even know what it says. I think so. Now, in court, politics have nothing to do with it. In court, there will be motions filed, there will be hearings, and ultimately there will be a trial. But all of that is done in that vacuum of the courtroom. And so I think by the time we get to the election, it is also possible that there will be other criminal charges pending, maybe in Georgia, maybe a federal case. And so the landscape is probably going to look very different 18 months from now when we're actually at the trial time. And my guess is that it's going to be worse and not better.
Lisa, you and I talked about the fact that in addition to all the accusations of illegitimacy, in addition to the sort of anti-Semitic and racist tropes of a Soros-backed guy who they call an animal, in addition to that, Donald Trump is now talking about the prosecution itself being election interference. Now, I worry when you said that, I worry that that means that even if there's a verdict that is that Donald Trump doesn't like, he can't resist that if he gets convicted. But his people can if they are convinced for months on end that this is illegitimate and it's election interference.
Absolutely. And Ali, one of the things that I think he's doing here that's so dangerous is seeding an entirely new election interference narrative, because he understands that the old narrative is both as false as it is dangerous for the fortunes of the Republican Party writ large. The Republican Party cannot afford to ignore mail-in voting, absentee voting, even ballot harvesting, which, as Sean Hannity noted last week in an interview with Trump, is perfectly lawful in a vast majority of states. Donald Trump knows that, and he's finally come around around to that. But he has to keep the narrative of election interference alive and enter these investigations, which are now taking the place of the big lie. Instead of the big lie, you have the big investigation. And he needs to keep that alive. His victimization is key to his success. And of course, what's really troubling here is these prosecutions and investigations are not election interference at all. They are simply people following the facts and the law. But for these investigations, however, I question whether Donald Trump would even be a candidate. He's the one who's trying to interfere with elections by making himself a candidate where he might not ordinarily have that interest, but for the fact that he's trying to outrun these investigations.
It's interesting you say that because there's someone else in the world, Benjamin Netanyahu, who is under indictment and got himself reelected to being the president of Israel. And then in the midst of something called judicial reforms, included a clause that said that you can't, very hard to remove him from government. So I want to go back to this with you, Barbara, and ask, to what degree, because there are more prosecutions potentially to come, some federal, some civil, and the Georgia DA, does everybody get together and say, we're running into a problem because Donald Trump will actually make this the center of his reelection campaign?
No, not at all, Ellie. Prosecutors, right out of the DOJ manual, says that political concerns are not to be taken into consideration when making charging decisions. Not only will they not think about it, they're directed not to consider it. It would be an improper consideration. Prosecutors are supposed to look at the facts and the law to decide whether they can obtain and sustain a conviction. And then they look at things like, is there a substantial federal interest in bringing this case? You don't bring every jaywalking case and every littering case because it's not worth the resources. But when you have someone who has abused power or violated laws that other people get prosecuted for, then standing down just because a person is a presidential candidate would violate the rule of law. And really, that's what all these critics are saying, aren't they? They haven't even seen the charges yet, and they're complaining about this unprecedented prosecution of a former president and a current candidate. What they're really saying is he should get special treatment just because he's a former president or he's a presidential candidate. And that is not how this country works. That is not how the rule of law works.
I want to read you something, Lisa, about Mark Pomerantz. This is Donald Trump posted about Mark Pomerantz, in which he says, don't forget the Clinton lawyer Mark Pomerantz, who left private practice to become a DA prosecutor of President Donald J. Trump, only to leave during the investigative process to sell a book and tainting the entire case, heretofore unheard of stuff. It's not supposed to work that way. And then in all caps, election interference, kangaroo court. Very much like many of Donald Trump's posts, there's a lot of information in there. What is he talking about?
I think what he's talking about is that Mark Pomerantz sort of laid bare in his book a lot of the thinking of the Manhattan District Attorney's Office during the period of time that Mark Pomerantz was serving, which was basically through the end of Cy Vance's tenure and a couple of months into Alvin Bragg's tenure. And he talked at length about various flaws with legal theories that they sort of tried on and discarded. And now, having had that information in the public domain, Donald Trump is saying, wait a second, Mark Pomerantz told the whole world that this case was nothing and Alvin Bragg has resuscitated it. That must mean that it's politically motivated. I think that narrative is entirely wrong. Putting aside whether it was proper for Mark Pomerantz to put that book into the public domain, I think what happened was Alvin Bragg came into office. He had not been in the Manhattan DA's office previously. In fact, he had a long career as a prosecutor in federal domain and in the New York Attorney General's office, and said, wait a second, I just got here. I need some time to familiarize my staff and my senior leadership with your investigation. I need to wrap my arms around this. And by all accounts, including according to a new New York Times story, that's exactly what he did. But Donald Trump is going to seize on the Pomerantz book as exemplars of prosecutorial misconduct, selective prosecution, and he's going to run with that book all the way through pretrial motion practice within New York State Court is much more robust than it is in the federal system.
Thanks to both of you this morning, as always. Lisa, thanks again all week for helping me out to understand this much more clearly than I would have on my own.
Barbara
McQuaid is the former United States attorney, MSNBC legal analyst. Lisa Rubin is a former litigator, also an MSNBC legal analyst. All right, NBC News has learned that Donald Trump is heading to New York City on Monday night. He's expected to arrive at the courthouse in Lower Manhattan around 1 p.m. on Tuesday before heading back to the airport to fly back to Florida later in the day. Coming up, I'll discuss the Republican response response to Trump's indictment, including some potentially dangerous rhetoric and some racist dog whistles. Plus, I'll talk about the future and the current state of American democracy with the man who helped save it back in 2020, Judge Michael Luttig. For more on the indictment of Donald Trump and what the week ahead may bring, I'm joined by David Rode, the executive editor of NewYorker.com and an MSNBC contributor, the author of numerous books, including In Deep, The FBI, The CIA, and The Truth About America's Deep State. The book details the lengths to which then-Attorney General Bill Barr went to shield Donald Trump at the U.S. Justice Department. But, David, it becomes increasingly relevant here because all of the seeds that were planted about the deep state since before Donald Trump was elected by Donald Trump and his allies is coming to play this week in this indictment. The idea that there is a they out there out to get people and that Donald Trump is the lightning rod for them. He is the thing that stands between people and a deep state that is illegitimate.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary moment. And this is sort of years in the making. And at its core, this is about, you know, is it possible for there to be nonpartisan public servants? I think we need them. We need nonpartisan judges. We need nonpartisan police officers. We need nonpartisan election officials who can count votes, you know, after elections, and we can trust their outcome. So that's going to be the broader, you know, narrative here, that everyone is political, everyone is biased, no one's honest, no one wants to just do the right thing, regardless of politics. And I don't think that's true. I think we need more nonpartisan public service in this country. We need more trust in each other, because otherwise it's just this sort of endless spiral of accusations and conspiracy theories.
But one of the reasons to have you here in this conversation is because you cover these stories around the world. And it is not atypical in any instance where a current or former politician gets indicted that they don't lean into this. This is a tried and true recipe, right? That this is a persecution, not a prosecution.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned earlier Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, but there's a long history. There's several former leaders of France that have been brought up on charges. Italy, Berlusconi has been criminally investigated. It's an unfortunate thing. It hasn't happened in the U.S., but it does happen in certain countries. But I want to emphasize what was said earlier, and you've said it yourself. Donald Trump, like every single American, is innocent until proven guilty. He deserves a fair trial. He may get acquitted here. And if he gets acquitted, you know, we have to accept that this was the verdict of our peers. And that's our system. This is the rule of law.
Well, that's the interesting part, though, because I would have expected Thursday night's responses, both from Donald Trump and from his supporters, to say something similar to that hey, innocent until proven guilty. This is America. I think this is not a legitimate charge, but the point is I'm going to have my day in court to prove it. There was precious little of that out there in the ether. There was all witch hunt, Soros, socialist, politically motivated prosecution.
I agree. And to be honest, I think this is, in a way, a political opportunity for Donald Trump. If he could tone down the rhetoric, act calmly, be arraigned in court, and maybe be acquitted of these charges, that would all help him politically. The danger, I think, for him is if there's violence. You know, there's Marjorie Taylor Greene is coming to New York on Tuesday to be part of a protest there. The flyer advertising that I'm on a mailing list of emails and I got it from local Republicans, you know, says it's supposed to be peaceful. So it's up to him. I think if there's violence, if he's constantly attacking the judge and the jury and saying this is all unfair, I think that will alienate, you know, key suburban moderate voters, you know, who did not vote for Donald Trump back candidates in the midterms. And, you know, he will create even larger problems for himself in a general election.
David, I want to switch gears for a second. Russian authorities have detained an American reporter, Evan Gershkovich, he's a Wall Street Journal reporter. They've accused him of spying and attempting to obtain state secrets. Now, you've posted on your Twitter quite a bit about his detainment, and you also understand quite deeply this issue of state-held, wrongfully detained people. Tell me what you make of this situation.
This is part of a sort of tragic and growing pattern. There's now at least 54 Americans being held around the world unjustly, and it's changed. Years ago, it was extremist groups that were, you know, grabbing Americans. Now it's authoritarian governments. Evan is the latest one. There's at least two other Americans. Paul Whelan has been held for 4 years, an American under false espionage charges. Mark Fogel, an American school teacher, was arrested for having a small amount of medical marijuana in Russia and sentenced to 16 years in prison. I work with people who know Evan incredibly well. He's a great journalist, and this is just a tragedy for him. And it's Vladimir Putin wanting to prevent any independent journalism from occurring inside Russia.
David, thanks very much for your coverage and for your analysis this morning. David Rode is the executive editor of NewYorker.com and an MSNBC contributor. He's also the author of In Deep, the FBI, the CIA, and the truth about America's deep state. Quote, the institutions of our democracy and law are under vicious, unsustainable, and unendurable attack, end quote. That's the warning from Judge Michael Luttig, the former federal judge on the U.S. of Court of Appeals. He joins me next. This week, President Biden held a global conference on democracy, stating to leaders around the globe that the United States is, quote, demonstrating the resilience of American democracy, end quote. Now, I hate to say it, but I can't say that I'm seeing much proof of that resilient democracy these days. I tend to agree more with something that Judge Michael Luttig said last week. Quote, the institutions of our democracy and law are under vicious, unsustainable, and unendurable attack from within. American democracy and the rule of law are in peril. The pillars of our democracy and the rule of law are faltering from these attacks as we speak today. With the former president's and his Republican Party's determined denial of January 6th, their refusal to acknowledge that the former president lost the 2020 presidential election fair and square, and their promise that the 2024 election will not be, quote, stolen from them again, as they maintain it was in 2020. America's democracy and the rule of law are in constitutional peril still, and there is no end to the threat in sight, end quote. That was Judge Michael Luttig, former federal judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Judge Luttig has long been regarded as a leading conservative legal mind, but you might know him for his role in helping to preserve our democracy on January 6, 2021. Judge Luttig gave that speech that I just quoted from at the University of Georgia School of Law on March 22nd. And as a result of that speech, we made a plan to have Judge Luttig on the show today, having nothing to do with the Manhattan grand jury indictment of former President Trump. Like many Americans, Judge Luttig's concern for American democracy is rooted in the events around January 6th. We now know that in the days before the insurrection, then President Trump tried to convince then Vice President Pence to use his power in the Senate to overturn the results of the election. Pence's personal lawyer called Judge Luttig for help. Luttig quickly wrote up his opinion that the vice president had no power to change the outcome, and he posted it on Twitter. And on January 6th, Pence's staff incorporated Mr. Luttig's reasoning, citing him by name, into a letter announcing that Pence would not try to block the counting of the electoral vote. Now, as we watch the GOP abandon pretense of operating under the rule of law, of operating with democratic values, this conversation feels more prescient than ever. Joining me now is Judge Michael Luttig, the former federal judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth District. Judge Luttig, good morning. Good to see you. Thank you for joining us this morning. And I want to talk about that speech because that was the reason we booked you. During the speech you gave at the University of Georgia School of Law, you were addressing mostly law students, and you said, quote, indeed, it might not be much overstatement, if any, to say that during your lifetime, this great nation of laws in which we are privileged to live will effectively decide whether it will live by the rule of law or whether it will live by the rule of politics. So all-consuming has become the politicization of our country, our institutions of democracy, and now even our institutions of law. Tell me more about that, sir.
Ali, thank you for having me on with you today. The perils for American democracy and the rule of law actually crested with Thursday's indictment in Manhattan and the Republican Party's continued denial of January 6th and its refusal to acknowledge the former president lost the 2020 election. There's now no end in sight to these perils. In the months ahead, America's democracy and rule of law will be severely tested, and hopefully not beyond the breaking point. If the former president was to be indicted in any of the pending criminal investigation, into his offenses against the United States. It should have been first for his offenses in attempting to overturn the 2020 election. What will now be the prosecution in Manhattan is the very last prosecution the country would have wanted to be the first prosecution of a president of the United States, and the first prosecution of this president in particular. Frankly, it ill serves the nation for this indictment to be the first indictment of a president in our history. The trial in Manhattan promises to be a spectacle, unbecoming of the United States, and immensely damaging to the United States of America. As Peggy Noonan put it in the Wall Street Journal this past week, while this indictment and prosecution is perhaps not beneath the former president, it is beneath us as Americans. On the other hand, the effort to overturn the 2020 election and the attack on the United States Capitol were unprecedented and grave offenses against not only America's democracy, but also the rule of law. It's the investigation into these grave offenses where there is urgency, not into the matter of the president and Stormy Daniels. Unfortunately, I'm afraid that this indictment out of Manhattan is the high cost to the nation of the inevitably protracted, but nonetheless protracted investigation by the Department of Justice into the events of January 6th. I guess what the Manhattan indictment will do, though, is ratchet up exponentially the pressure on Jack Smith and the Department of Justice, as well as the district attorney in Fulton County, Georgia, to seek indictments as quickly as possible, if they are going to. And if those indictments are forthcoming soon, they will eclipse the indictment in Manhattan and refocus the country on the former president's conduct that should be the focus, his effort to overturn the 2020 election.
Well, both of those, or the other cases of which you speak, the two federal cases, the Georgia indictment, even the documents case, all of them do perhaps have greater degrees of complexity than the one facing the Manhattan jury. Back in January in the Washington Post, the Washington Post published an in-depth profile on you and quoted you saying that Donald Trump's role in the insurrection is arguably the worst crime against the United States that a president could commit. And you asserted at the time in that article that there was ample evidence against him, and that just may be the beginning of the end of Donald Trump. Do you hold the same opinion, given the unwavering support within the Republican Party for Donald Trump right now, even amongst his opponents, his potential opponents, or those like Mike Pence, who think that he did their family, his family, a great deal of harm?
Ali, I hold the same opinion, all the more because of the Republicans' circling of the wagons to protect the former president. And as I mentioned at the top of this segment, their now unified and continuing insistence that the former president won the 2020 presidential election, and that January 6th was nothing to be concerned about. But let me also say for your viewers, Ali, that the investigations, both by the Department of Justice and in Fulton County by District Attorney Fannie Willis, they are large, even massive investigations.
Right.
But as such, the indictments and prosecutions there, if there are to be those, actually would not be as complicated as a matter of law as this indictment in Manhattan promises and appears to be.
I just want to ask you, because we've got some comments from Michael Pence right now, and he has mentioned, among other things, when he was asked about January 6th, he said that Donald Trump was, I'm paraphrasing here, was fed incorrect information from his advisors that day, but that Pence was always confident in what his duty was in terms of certifying the vote. Now, no one was closer to this situation than you, because it was Mike Pence's lawyer who contacted you to say, can you give us some cover in terms of your legal scholarship? Do you believe that to be true, that Pence was always confident that he was not in a position to do what Donald Trump wanted in overturning the election in Congress?
I don't have any insight into the conversations and machinations within the White House, but I have no question at all that the former vice president always believed from the outset that he had no authority to unilaterally overturned the election on January 6th, Allie.
Thank you for that, sir. We appreciate your time, as always, and your wisdom. Judge Michael Luttig is a former federal judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Well, Republicans and the right have rushed to rally behind the former president, saying the indictment against him is everything from anti-democratic to the start of war. Up next, I'll discuss the real danger posed by that sort of rhetoric and the anti-Semitic trope at the center of the response. A select few high-ranking Republican officials, including Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, have yet to publicly react to the news that Donald Trump has been criminally indicted. So what is emerging is a very vocal majority of Republican public figures offering near uniform support, with some even using the indictment as a rallying cry, using language that undermines the justice system. Some have indirectly alluded to violence, including one TV personality publicly saying now is not a good time to get rid of your AR-15 rifles. Another saying that the indictment means that by 2025, the country will be at, quote, war and living in a virtual police state, and that the U.S. dollar will collapse. NBC News has learned that Donald Trump has been reaching out to Republican allies on the Hill to consult about next steps, including to Representative Matt Gaetz and Senator Lindsey Graham, who, after the January 6th insurrection, famously said on the floor of the Senate that Trump could count him out, but is now pleading with viewers of Fox News to donate to Trump's campaign to offset his legal bills. Lindsey Graham also posted on Twitter, quote, how can President Trump avoid prosecution in New York? On the way to the DA's office on Tuesday, Trump should smash some windows, rob a few shops, and punch a cop. He would be released immediately. All caps, exclamation point. House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy has essentially vowed to weaponize the chamber for Trump's defense, promising to hold investigations and to, in his words, hold the Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg accountable, whatever that means. Even former Republican Congressman Peter Meyer, one of the few House Republicans who voted to impeach Trump following January 6th and who lost his seat over that vote, is backing Trump, calling for an indictment, calling the indictment, quote, weak effing sauce. He didn't say effing. He used the whole word. While Trump's own daughter, Ivanka Trump, offered a slightly more tame response, posting on Instagram, quote, I love my father and I love my country. Today I am pained for both. I appreciate the voices across the political spectrum expressing support and concern, end quote. After the break, we're going to take a look at how this type of rhetoric is far more than a dog whistle and just how dangerous it is to Americans and our society. Joining me now is Joanne Freeman. She's a professor of history and American studies at Yale University, the president of the Society for Historians of the Early American Republic, and the author of The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to the Civil War. Also with me is Jennifer Rubin. She's an opinion writer with The Washington Post and a political MSNBC political analyst. She's also the author of Resistance, How Women Saved Democracy from Donald Trump. Her latest piece in The Washington Post gets right to the heart of the matter. Trump is indicted and justice is served. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for being with us. I want to ask you, Jennifer, because I think there's just something that we can't say enough because of all of the Republican responses, almost all that I saw from Congress, members of Congress, about Alvin Bragg. There have been some dehumanizing things that Donald Trump has said about Alvin Bragg in the last words and last weeks, including calling him an animal. And there's this endless reference to Soros backed. Everybody says it. Now, I think that some people in good faith don't know what they're saying. But those people who started these things do know what they're saying. Soros backed means something very specific.
It certainly does. George Soros is a Holocaust survivor of Hungarian birth who is a major donor to various democratic and progressive causes, as is his constitutional right. He is in no way tied to Alvin Bragg. He has not given money to Alvin Bragg. He has not met with Alvin Bragg. But by citing the name of George Soros and intimating that this is part of a conspiracy, part of a secret society, Republicans who are invoking his name are raising the specter, the anti-Semitic specter of Jews who control the media, Jews who control government, Jews who control a great deal of the money in the United States. This is anti-Semitism, plain and simple. And I'm very disturbed when press accounts of this do not explain this to the American people. Yeah. And they simply repeat, they simply parrot the statement that he's Soros-backed. And sometimes they even neglect to say that Mr. Soros is Jewish. Well, the people who are saying this and the people to whom they are saying it, the base, understand quite well what this is about. This is about anti-Semitism. And at a time in which anti-Semitism is skyrocketing in this country, in which the second gentleman has gone to Europe, has treated this as the problem that it is in trying to rally a whole of government approach. This is entirely unacceptable. It's unacceptable for Republicans. It's unacceptable for the media not to explain this and to call Republicans out for it. And I fear that we are once again normalizing very abnormal behavior and unacceptable behavior.
And that's why it's important to say this, because Joanne, it just becomes part of conversation, and people will probably start casually saying, you know, he's funded and backed by George Soros, without realizing that what you are saying is you are drudging up old imagery, very successful old anti-Semitic imagery of literally a Jewish puppet master, whether it be finance or media or politics, and now the justice system, and a black man who the suggestion might be is hapless. He couldn't do what he's doing but for the fact that this rich Jew is controlling him. I think it is important to call this what it is. You can decide what you like about this prosecution or Alvin Bragg or not, but this is something else. This is the othering of the prosecutors.
It's absolutely vital for any number of reasons. So, yes, it's the othering of prosecutors. I do think it's normalizing pretty blatantly anti-Semitic language. And a lot of people are certainly denying this. And as you said at the outset, Ali, it might be that some people are not aware that the name Soros is now being used as a kind of anti-Semitic banner in the same way that earlier in this century, Rothschild was a name that was thrown around. You said Rothschild and everyone knew, oh, you mean the world network of Jews trying to control everything. It's blatantly anti-Semitic, and it's being used in that way to other people. And as was just said, I think making that known to people who honestly don't know it, and I've certainly gotten a lot of pushback for the simple fact of stating that it's anti-Semitic, it's pretty important that people understand what it is and what it means that people in power are using it.
Stand by to both of you, please. Joanne Freeman and Jennifer Rubin. We're going to come back right after the break with more of this conversation. Stay with us. Still with me, Joanne Freeman, professor of history and American studies at Yale University, Jennifer Rubin, opinion writer with The Washington Post, and MSNBC political analyst. Joanne, you're an expert on violence in politics. A couple of things that have happened this week or in the last couple of weeks have stood out to me. One is Donald Trump calling for people to protest and take back the nation. On Thursday night, a host at Fox had said this is not a good time to give up your AR-15s. You saw the Lindsey Graham comment on maybe if Donald Trump smashes some windows and punches a cop in the face, he'll be immediately released. He was meaning that, by the way, in the context that people are accusing Alvin Bragg of being soft on crime generally. But the bottom line is we're in this fraught moment where First Amendment rights intact, one might want to be cautious about things that suggest violence.
Oh, for sure. It's irresponsible very blatantly irresponsible to use that kind of language. I think it's also important to note that part of the reason, part of the rationale for using that kind of language is precisely for what we're talking about here, which is that if you spread that kind of talk, essentially you're making threats. And the idea behind that is to get people who oppose you to back down, to remain silent. You know, it feeds into this general idea that, we better not do anything against Trump, because if we do, it's going to get people angry and there will be violence. You don't amend or subtract the rule of law because you're afraid that there might be violence if you enforce it. So part of what we're seeing with this language is bullying, deliberate bullying, and an attempt to cow people who are opposed to former President Trump and this indictment movement. And that matters a lot, in addition to the fact that it is simply irresponsible by potentially encouraging people who might be particularly eager to be violent.
Let me ask you about this. Jen, you were a lawyer in addition to being a commentator and a journalist. What I was surprised at in the reactions by people who were wanting to support Donald Trump was the idea that this was not a trial. This was an indictment. He gets an absolute trial. He's absolutely presumed to be innocent, regardless of what some people might think, until otherwise determined by a jury of his peers. Representative Don Bacon of Nebraska had said on Friday morning, it seems inappropriate for some to be so joyful over someone's indictment or to criticize a prosecutor for making an indictment before we're even able to read the indictment. Let's get the facts and see how this plays out. There will be time for us all to make a better judgment. I would have expected dozens of things like Don Bacon said. I still can't find anything other than the one that Don Bacon said.
Not on the Republican side. I do commend Democrats. Virtually all the elected leaders have been saying something along the lines that this illustrates no one's above the law. He has the presumption of innocence. We should not comment. Let the law go forward. And I don't think anyone should be confused, as Joanne says. This is precisely what Trump did in the run-up to January 6th. He knows there are fanatics out there. He knows there are armed, dangerous people. He is inciting them. And the risk that somebody who is, quite frankly, not mentally all there and not entirely in touch with the reality will take this up as an order to go forward, just as the people on January 6th took his words to be wild as an order from the president of the United States to go up to the Hill and try to create a riot, try to prevent the peaceful transfer of power. There are people who will listen to this and take him seriously. He is now invoking Alvin Bragg by name. He is now invoking the name of the judge who is going to arraign him, saying that he hates Donald Trump. That particular judge actually presided in the criminal trial of the fraud of the corporation that Donald Trump heads. So once you start invoking the names of people who are involved in the justice system and using this kind of language, that becomes a threat. And I would not be surprised at all. In fact, I would hope that the judge at the arraignment next week on Tuesday says to Donald Trump, this has to stop. If you don't, you're going to be back here. You're going to be subject to a gag order, which is enforceable by contempt. You cannot go out there and try to influence the jury pool. You cannot go out there and try to whip up the mob. That's not going to be tolerated. And I fear that if he doesn't do that, that we're in for a host of trouble. And we already see that Alvin Bragg has just been inundated by an avalanche of threats. The people who work in that courthouse are in danger. The people of New York are in danger. The police in New York are in danger, and there's no way that we should be tolerating this. This was the mode of operation on January 6th, and shame on us if we don't take it seriously
right.
And don't prepare for it.
Right. We have actually seen this before, so we want to make sure that having known how this can unfold, we take all precautions that it doesn't unfold this way. Thanks to both of you. Great to see you. Joanne Freeman is a professor of history and American studies at Yale University, the author of a book about political violence, The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to the Civil War. Jennifer Rubin is an opinion writer with The Washington Post and an author of Resistance, How Women Saved Democracy from Donald Trump. Still ahead, former Vice President Mike Pence said this week that no man is above the law, including former presidents, but he also maintains that the Trump indictment is, quote, the criminalization of politics. Straight ahead, I'll talk to his former senior advisor, Olivia Troy, about Pence's thinking and his political calculations as he reportedly continues to mull a 2024 White House run. Another hour of Velshi begins right now. Good morning. It's Saturday, April the 1st. I'm Ali Velshi. This week marked another inflection point for the state of our democracy. Donald Trump, the rookie politician who somehow made it into the White House with zero political experience, only to be disgraced as the first president to be impeached twice while in office. It's now the first current or former president to be criminally indicted in U.S. history. NBC News has learned that his indictment includes about 30 charges related to document fraud. That's classified as misdemeanors. And the Associated Press is reporting that according to its sources, Trump is also facing at least one felony charge stemming from the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's investigation of the former president's role in the hush money payments made to the former adult film actress Stormy Daniels, with whom he allegedly had an affair. Donald Trump denies that there was an affair. In a new interview with the London-based Times Radio that aired yesterday, Daniels said she's not afraid and even hopes to be called to testify against Trump. Trump's indictment is expected to remain sealed until Tuesday afternoon, when he's scheduled to turn himself in to be formally arraigned at a Manhattan courthouse. While there, he will be fingerprinted, processed, and have the charges read to him. Judge Juan Merchan will oversee the case. Coincidentally, he's the same judge who presided over the Trump Organization's criminal tax fraud trial late last year that resulted in the company being fined the maximum penalty of $1.6 million. Now, none of that, the unsealing of the document, the indictment, the formal arraignment, and all of the logistics that go with it, none of that has happened yet. But Trump and many of his allies have already begun criticizing and accusing the justice system of being corrupt and biased against him. Donald Trump, like anyone accused of a crime in the United States, is presumed innocent until proven guilty. He's also entitled to his day in court to defend himself. But his focus at the moment seems to be delegitimizing the justice system altogether, calling the investigation politically motivated, attacking the prosecutor Alvin Bragg, and throwing around allegations of election interference. Politically, it's a message that is working for him. Donald Trump has been fundraising off the news of his indictment, and his campaign says it received more than $4 million in new donations in the first 24 hours after the news of the indictment broke. I'm joined by Paul Butler, a former federal prosecutor and an MSNBC legal analyst. Paul, good morning to you. Thank you for being with us. What do you make of everything that's happened? Since I know you've been covering this and you've been on this on TV with us in the last few days, but where we are now, we now know when Donald Trump's coming to Manhattan. We know how this is going to proceed. And we know about the relentless attack by Donald Trump and Republican supporters about the legal system and on Alvin Bragg himself.
So, Ali, this is not a political prosecution, but it is a policy-based prosecution. Bragg ran for office on a platform of equal justice under the law. And that's what Trump and his allies are mad about. When it's poor people and black and brown people who are targets of no-knock warrants and prosecutions for misdemeanors. They love that. But who can forget President Trump telling those cops, when you arrest suspects, don't treat them too nicely. It's okay if they bang their heads when they're getting in the squad car. Now that it's Trump whose head might get banged, these Republicans have suddenly developed a critique of the criminal legal system.
Let's talk a little bit about the danger and the threat to the prosecutors. That was always going to be the case in such a political case, except that Donald Trump has gone out of his way, and very much almost every other Republican response that we looked at from members of Congress go out of their way to talk about the left-wing, radicalized, socialist Alvin Bragg. Now, Donald Trump has also in the recent past called him an animal and posted to Truth Social, reposted a picture of him with a baseball bat and Alvin Bragg's head. So there's more here than the normal animus between a defendant and their prosecutor.
Such an important point, Ali. Trump doesn't like any prosecutor who's going after him, but his critiques of D.A. Bragg and also Fannie Willis in Georgia, it's about their intellect and qualifications. And that's different than what he said about Robert Mueller or Jack Smith. Look, when Bragg was a federal prosecutor, he specialized in public corruption. He now has this dream team of experienced assistant district attorneys who've been working this case for 2 years. Bragg has already beat the Trump Organization in one criminal case. He got a big, fat, guilty conviction against the corporation and its former CFO. Black prosecutors are used to being underestimated. Ali, it happened to me all the time when I was doing public corruption cases with the Department of Justice. Trump and his allies underestimate Bragg at their peril.
There's also the second part of it. We were talking about the anti-Semitism of constantly quoting George Soros or calling him Soros back. The man has never met George Soros. George Soros did not directly contribute to him. He contributed to a fund that supported liberal prosecutors. That said, the implication of the Jewish puppet master also by implication is that Bragg's not smart enough to have figured this out on his own.
Exactly. Again, it's this constant demeaning of the intellect of African-Americans generally, and in this case, black lawyers. And again, it's not about fairness. They're not concerned about that at all. A few years ago, a report demonstrated that the Manhattan district attorney sometimes treats black and brown defendants differently than white defendants. That study found several racial disparities. And I give the Manhattan DA credit for commissioning that report. Most prosecutor offices don't even collect that information because they don't want to know. The reality is that the Trump supporters who are saying that there are two different justice systems in this country are exactly right. But it's rich white men like Donald Trump who get all the advantages. There were a poor person or a black or brown person who were subject to all the investigations that Trump has been subject to. They would have been charged a long time ago.
Kevin McCarthy said that Congress is going to investigate Alvin Bragg. I'm actually surprised that Alvin Bragg gave them the dignity of your response, but he did write back and say, you don't actually have any authority over me.
Congress has no jurisdiction over this state criminal case. The DA's office told the congressman their job is to pass laws. A criminal investigation of Trump by New York State has nothing to do with that. In fact, the DA's office is required by federal and state law to be independent of political interference. So when the Republicans in Congress are asking what they're asking Bragg to do, it actually violates the Constitution, the principle of separation of powers. It would break the law in New York for DA Bragg to reveal confidential grand jury information. He actually did what the Republicans wanted him to do. He would be committing a crime.
Paul Butler, good to see you as always. Thank you. Paul Butler is a former federal prosecutor and an MSNBC legal analyst. Joining me now is Olivia Troy, former senior aide to Mike Pence during his tenure as vice president. Olivia, good to see you. Just the other day, your old boss said nobody's above the law, including former presidents. Yet here he is on Fox News just yesterday.
The unprecedented indictment of a former president of the United States on a campaign finance issue is outrageous. The details that will follow will not change that fact. And I think millions of Americans looking on see this for what it is. It's a political prosecution by a Manhattan DA who literally campaigned for office on a pledge to indict the former president. The Attorney General of New York campaigned for office on a pledge to go after that same American. And this is not an expression of equal treatment under the law that every American deserves. This just is one more example of this two-tiered justice system that has so many Americans literally questioning the fundamental fairness of the administration of justice in our country.
Once again, Olivia, I do love the fact that your former boss does tend to confound me because he does have strong opinions on what Donald Trump did to him and risking his family and his safety. He's not a fan of how Donald Trump has behaved. And he's presented himself as a guy who values fairness in politics, at least on that front when it comes to democracy. What's going on?
Again, another disappointing day in the life of Mike Pence. Look, I mean, what is really actually even more egregious here and upsetting is the fact that millions of Americans believe that, Mike Pence, because you are lying to them every single day. You and others who are the leaders of the Republican Party are delivering these narratives that are false and are undermining our government institutions and our judicial system. That's why those millions of Americans think that this is a political hit job. They didn't just make that up. And by doing that, my greater problem with this, Ali, is the fact that he's attacking Americans who are sitting on that grand jury. That is what these people are doing. They're attacking their peers who are sitting there on that jury, the jury that is making this decision, who is looking at all the facts. And, you know, and that's how they're issuing these rulings. It's not Alvin Bragg on his own doing this in a silo. It's how the judicial process works.
But the problem is that the people that need to hear it aren't hearing it, because all of these people are on these networks pushing the same lies every single day.
Yeah, and the lie is interesting to me, because even those who I've sort of been mentioning a few times in the last hour or so, people who had the opportunity to say, alas, there's a justice system. There will be a jury of his peers. There will be a judge supervising this. He will have the ability to have his lawyers in court. He will have his day, and he will be proved not to be guilty of these crimes. But that's not the response. The response tends to be witch hunt, politicization, George Soros, lefty radicals, whatever the case is. I'm puzzled why Republicans aren't just putting forth, like I said, I've read a quote from Don Bacon of Nebraska. He's the only one who has said, I trust our legal system. There's checks and balances with a jury, judges, and appeals. President Trump will be able to make his defense, and we'll all see if this is a partisan prosecution or not. There's the answer.
That's exactly it. And look, this is a moment, a defining moment for our country, I believe. And the damage that all of these people are doing will likely last decades, because it's very hard to come back from this, especially for our democracy. And they could be exhibiting leadership instead. They could choose to say, let this play out. Let's sit back, see what happens. By the way, all these people who want that crown, the crown jewel of the Oval Office, right? A lot of these people are running for that slot. Instead of exhibiting the leadership that our country needs right now, I think this will backfire on them in the end. Because, look, not all Republican voters are okay with this. Not moderate voters. I mean, we're all sitting there. There's conservatives like me who are appalled at how this plays out, because it used to be that the Republican Party believed in the ideals of the rule of law. We were the party of like strong government, law enforcement, defense. But instead, here we are, and we're undermining our institutions over and over again. And I'll say this, look, I served in national security for almost 20 years in and around government under the Bush administration. I was a political appointee during that administration. I served under the Obama administration as a career intelligence officer, and then as a career intelligence officer under Trump. The only time that I had worry and sometimes sick to my stomach of watching the government be used against the people was under Trump. Whether it was the travel ban with racist undertones, where they bullied the intelligence community, where they wanted a certain narrative to be pushed out, and we were still strong. I'll give my colleagues credit. It was hard. There was that, whether it was Ukraine and Russia and what happened there. I lived the impeachment internally in the White House firsthand and how they handled that, whether it was COVID and the policies they were pushing and how they were pushing false narratives and sitting out there about Clorox and all that and bullying the CDC. That is what the Trump administration was. It was those people who were using the government against the American people. And so, you know, and Mike Pence was there for all of that.
There's a lot I want to
know the truth.
I want to keep on going on this conversation with you. Let's take a quick break and we'll continue on the other side. Olivia Troy is going to stay with me. Coming up, Donald Trump has been indicted, as you know, in the Stormy Daniels hush money case. But that is not the beginning or the end of his legal troubles. We will break down for you the seven investigations into Donald Trump, plus putting the Trump indictment into a global perspective, how other countries are looking at this rolling American news cycle and wondering what we can learn from other democracies that have grappled with criminal investigations of top public officials. All right, back with me is Olivia Troy, former senior aide to Mike Pence during his time as a vice president. Olivia, I want to sort of take a look. I'm going to ask Joe to help me with this. Take a look at the screen so we can take a look at the book that you've got on your shelf. You've got Michael Cohen's book, Disloyal. And that's interesting because this is a guy who is central to the prosecution, and Donald Trump has been attacking witnesses to this case. You have been one of those people who's sort of been on the wrong side of the government while you were in it.
Yes, and look, I appreciate you bringing that up, because this week, those of us who have been in touch with each other, you know, while people think that we might be celebrating behind the scenes, this has been a very anxious and very draining week personally for many of us who keep waiting for accountability. For someone who has done so many bad things along the way. And I have to say, there's been a heaviness across all of us. And yes, so there were tears across some of the circles of maybe finally relief that maybe the rule of law will actually catch up and play a role in this. But it has also been disheartening when we watch what happened across the Republican Party. And look, these people have destroyed lives. They're still doing it today. They're out there attacking people. They're out there spreading disinformation every single day that is so harmful. But at the end of the day, all of these people are human beings. And many of these people took a stand to tell the truth and spoke truth to power. And we're all just sitting here waiting to see how this plays out. And right. I just, for once, I'm looking for a leader. I'm looking for a leader on the right, a true leader to take a stand and say enough.
Because what happens here influences what people like you or others who are in government who decide to say, here's something that the American public needs to know that's incorrect. In other countries, and we're going to discuss this in a few minutes, in other countries, this often fails very badly for people who are critics, whistleblowers, opposition members, or who want to fix their own political party, as you do. What happens next with respect to witnesses and with respect to those who come forward is actually critical for the survival of the democracy moving forward.
That's exactly it. And my greatest fear is that should some of these people return to office and gain power in terms of these inner circles, you will see the decline of America as we see it today. We will no longer be that country. We're already on that path. And I can't, look, it's not hyperbole. This is where we are. We have a choice today as Americans. And I'm asking the Republican leaders out there, conservative leader, to please, look, we need to take a stand. We need two functioning parties to survive as a democracy, right? Yep. I mean, that is what our system is based on right now. We are better with a stronger, honest, cooperative Republican Party. That is what is needed right now. The only person I've actually seen somewhat speak with truth and make an honest statement about this whole situation is possibly Governor Hutchinson, yeah, who actually released a statement and said Donald Trump should not be president. And then he says it's up to the voters to decide. Okay, fair enough. But he didn't attack the DA. He didn't attack the judicial process.
Right, that's what
he said
the line.
Was,
that's the line.
It. That is the line.
Yeah.
Respect the process. Let it play out.
So Mike Pence is sort of straddling that line. He's calling it political. He doesn't go as far as others in calling it illegitimate. He doesn't use the racist and anti-Semitic tropes that we've seen. But tell me about what he's doing, trying to do, because he might be central, not to this particular investigation, but some of the others that are underway with respect to January 6th.
He is. And look, I think he is trying to figure out politically how he walks this fine line, how he courts those voters that are obviously still upset with him, the Trump followers out there. But the other issue is for Mike Pence, I think he's sort of, he himself has boxed himself into this situation because he has fully the right to speak out and start telling the truth. He could actually be a leader in this situation. I wanted him to be that leader on January, 7th, the very next day. I wanted him to stand up and say, look, this is all wrong. We're going the wrong direction here. We need to start actually functioning as a country. And what's happening here is there's this dangerous man that I have actually witnessed and lived behind the scenes firsthand what he's capable of, because he was there all 4 years, just like I was. And we have seen what this man is capable of doing, and his voice could be powerful. But instead, he is actually hurting himself, I think, and any political chance that he might have by going along with Donald Trump. He's playing his enabler once again. And so I think, what is he running for Donald Trump's vice president again? Is that what's happening here? Because that is what it looks like.
And yeah, I
can't tell you how disappointing that is.
It's strange because this is his moment to be able to say, I don't subscribe to this stuff. He sort of comes out and three quarter says it sometimes. And then, push comes to shove. He goes back into this unusual mode. Olivia, thanks a million. As always, Olivia Troy is a former Homeland Security advisor and counterterror advisor to then Vice President Mike Pence. Right after the break, the Stormy Daniels hush money case is not the only legal battle that Donald Trump is fighting. May not even be the first one to make it to trial, believe it or not. We're going to have more on the other investigations after this. NBC News has learned from a source with direct knowledge of the matter that in addition to his trip on Monday and Tuesday to New York for his arraignment in the Stormy Daniels hush money case, Donald Trump is expected to return to New York again the following week, the week of April 10th, to sit for a deposition in the New York Attorney General's civil fraud case against him. Maybe tough to keep track of the many and varied legal troubles Donald Trump is facing, so let's make it easy. He has the investigation and now indictment against him from the Manhattan District Attorney relating to the hush money payments made to Stormy Daniels at the end of the 2016 campaign cycle. He has that New York Attorney General civil case I just mentioned. Letitia James is suing Trump and the Trump Organization for fraud involving misleading representation of properties in order to get better loans and insurance. The penalty of that could be $250 million. The Fulton County District Attorney in Georgia is investigating Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election results in that state, which included then-President Trump's infamous phone call to Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, demanding he find enough votes for Trump to win. There are two Department of Justice investigations, both being overseen by Special Counsel Jack Smith. One focuses on Trump's role on January 6th. The other focuses on the tens of thousands of documents, classified and otherwise, which Trump took with him to Mar-a-Lago and other properties when he left the White House, and whether Trump tried to obstruct that investigation. Trump is also the subject of two defamation lawsuits by E. Jean Carroll, who previously accused Trump of rape in a department store in the mid-1990s. The second of those lawsuits could potentially go to trial later this month. Joining me now is Cynthia Oxney. She's a former federal prosecutor and an MSNBC legal analyst. Cynthia, these trials all take a lot of time. The Manhattan DA one is actually interesting because a lot of the information is already out there. There have been depositions. There's a lot of detail. But it's still going to take, I don't know, many months to a year or more. Talk to me about the timing of these cases. Is it clear that this one goes to trial first? Is it, if there are other indictments, would there be any reason for another one of these cases to go to trial ahead of this? How does that all work?
Well, this case will probably go to trial in about a year. So, you know, welcome to Easter next year. This is what we'll be doing. But remember, this month, two big cases are going to trial. Now, you said it's the E. Jean Carroll case. Okay, guess what? That's a rape case. It's not a case about E. Jean Carroll. It's a case about rape and then trashing the woman after rape. And that is not helpful. If you want to pick a jury down the road, it's not helpful that you've been accused of rape. So that affects the jury pool in this case, because they're both in Manhattan. And of course, there'll be so much national press no matter where it is. The other case that's going to trial this month is the Dominion suit. Now, the president is not a party to the Dominion suit, but fundamentally, the Dominion suit says the president lost the election and it was all BS. Okay, that doesn't help him at all. So those two cases are this month. And then we have all the other cases that you brought up. And all I can say about the other cases is, come on in, the water's warm. We're in the pool. Let's get going.
Is there any degree of coordination between the various people making these cases? Obviously, they've all got to get their own, whether it's the special grand jury in Georgia or Jack Smith, they've all got to get their own ducks in an order. But does anyone say to anybody else, mind if I get in front of you in line here? I got a plane to catch?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely. The only person who makes some kind of a calculation like that is Jack Smith, and he makes it within his own two big investigations. But no, there's no chance that Fannie Willis and Alvin Bragg and Jack Smith are strategizing. I think that would be improper, and I don't think any of them would do it.
So I was talking to Judge Michael Luttig earlier, who made an interesting comment. He said, this is the least good first case one would want to see on this front, largely because his concern is about American democracy and would have liked one of the cases that was more directly tied to Trump interfering in the democratic process to be heard first. What's your take on that?
Absolutely. I mean, the gravamen of Trump's crimes to me is essentially the seditious conspiracy. I mean, I think that's the heart and soul of it. And I have been on the record for a very long time that this is not my preference, but it is what it is. And here we are, and they were facing a statute of limitations issue and they had no choice. And I have to say, the more Trump threatens the prosecutor and the more he puts out baseball bats to the prosecutor's head and calls for death and destruction and other things, the stronger I feel that it's important to have this case go forward. Because here's what's happened. Nobody ever holds him to account. The goalposts are always moved. Everybody goes around him and moves the goal. I mean, Joe Tacopina, he's not a bad lawyer, and he's on television excusing this behavior. He knows better than that.
Yeah.
Everybody does that because this guy's such a bully. And because he's done this now, I feel more strongly about this case than, let's say, 6 months ago. I'd be like, oh, forget it. But right now that Trump has behaved this way, all you know, all engines forward. Let's go.
Cynthia, thank you, as always. We appreciate it. Cynthia Oxney is a former federal prosecutor and an MSNBC legal analyst. We just got an update, by the way, out of Arkansas. There have been a number of deadly storms across the South and the Midwest, including in Arkansas. Here you are seeing video of the governor of Arkansas, Sarah Sanders, who just made some public comments. I'm just going to check with my control room. Do we have those yet, or are we going to be turning that around? All right. We're gonna turn that around for you. At least 11 people are dead across the country, across the South and the Midwest, because of a series of storms that have taken place overnight. And of course, there are more storms that we had just the other day. We'll bring you complete coverage on those multiple catastrophic tornadoes that have torn through several states. Stay with us. The death toll from those deadly tornadoes that slammed parts of the United States has just gone up. Since we last reported on this story this morning, we have learned of four more deaths, bringing the total number of weather-related deaths to 11 across five states. Nearly 50 tornadoes reportedly ripped through several states late yesterday and into the morning. Little Rock took one of the biggest direct hits. The National Guard in the state has been activated, and a state of emergency is currently in effect. Joining us now, NBC News correspondent Ron Allen from Little Rock, Arkansas. And again, I remind people, Ron, Little Rock is a built up industrial area. It's a built up city. It's got city level infrastructure that typically doesn't get damaged by these kinds of storms. It got hit hard.
It got hit very hard, and it's a city of about 200,000 people, and the mayor and the governor just said that about 2,000 or so residents' homes were impacted, and that is what has happened to some of them. You can see some of the damage behind me. It's just unbelievable to see trees ripped up by their roots, roofs off homes, and these, as you say, are substantial homes. The governor pointed out that there have been five confirmed fatalities in this state. There's still about 27 to 30,000 people without power. She's been in touch with President Biden and FEMA, she said, and the federal government has offered to help in any way they can. Unclear what resources they may be sending here. But yes, it's been quite a scene here, not all over Little Rock, but in pockets, because we know hurricanes, tornadoes come and rip through a swath of an area. Some meteorologists locally have been reporting that it may have been about a half a mile wide, and it may have been on the ground in the state for as far as 40 miles, which is pretty significant. Here's a man, a witness who saw it coming. Listen to what he had to say.
I looked back and there was the tornado coming up over the hill. So got out of my truck and started running for a shelter. Made it into one of the little salons over here. Got in, and as I got in, huddled up against the cement barrier, every single glass window blew out and people were blown back. And I held on, and it must have been a minute just huddled. I thought I was a goner for sure.
As far as we know, he is okay. The governor and mayor just said that the hospitals are not at capacity and they are able to deal with the dozens or so of patients who have come in beginning last night. There's still some hospitalized, but we don't have a lot of detail about their conditions. But what you see across this town in these pockets that were hit by the tornado is a lot of cleanup. We hear a lot of chainsaws everywhere because there are so many trees that have been ripped up. And that's going to go on here for some time. Again, as far as we know, there's still a state of emergency in effect here while this cleanup tries to gather some momentum today.
Yeah, it's always amazing, Allie, how quickly after these series of storms, at first light, you see people coming out and they're not sitting around lamenting. It's always amazing to see people just start getting to work, even in the smallest ways, sorting things out. We've been looking at the aerial photographs of this. And one of the things that is interesting is while tornadoes do sometimes just have a narrow path and you can have somebody down the street completely unaffected by it, in that path, it looks as if houses and cars were put through a shredder.
Yeah, and this is one place as we were driving in here where we could see where the tornado apparently jumped over a highway. Across the way in that direction is a strip mall of stores, and they're damaged. And then there's a place where there's no damage. And yes, it's the thing about tornadoes, they're just so random. And yes, the shredding, that's a good word to describe it. What it does to communities. I mean, these places are devastated. They seem inhabitable. They're trying to restore power as best they can. There's still again, pockets that are not without power. And again, we don't want to leave the impression that the entire capital city is devastated. That's not the case. But there are areas, significant areas, with significant damage. And again, still a lot of concern. People trying to figure out what to do next, where they can get help, how they can begin to rebuild. The good news, it's a beautiful day here. And as you said, people are out and about. And this is also, I might point out, a community where faith is very strong. And there's a lot of talk about faith in the briefings from government officials and everyone else. And that seems very strong here as well.
Ron, good to see you. Thank you. And it is good that it's a sunny day because it does at least help people move on with the cleanup that is so important to both the rebuilding and the healing process. NBC's Ron Allen is live for us in Little Rock, Arkansas. We'll continue to bring you coverage of these devastating storms that seem to be going through America every day in the last few days. The world is watching America right now. Coming up next, the indictment of the former U.S. president from a global perspective. The criminal indictment of the former president of the United States of America is major news, not just here in the U.S., but around the world. Take a look at some of the headlines made internationally. In Calgary's Sun, the one word says it all, indicted. In Australia's Sydney Morning Herald, they provided live coverage of the story as it developed. The headline on France's Le Monde reads, Trump becomes first former American president to be indicted. The BBC asked, what happened between Stormy Daniels and Donald Trump? Following news of the indictment, Trump fired off a series of posts on his social media platform, Truth Social, including this quote, the USA is now a third world nation, a nation in serious decline. Trump's efforts to characterize a legal proceeding against him as a form of political persecution, akin to what happens in dictatorships, is not borne out by the facts. Democracies around the world routinely prosecute their leaders and former leaders for wrongdoing. The US is arguably an outlier in this respect. Might be worth looking at some of these examples from the last 20 years to better inform ourselves as our nation enters uncharted territory. Israel is perhaps the most obvious place to start, where mass protests have engulfed the nation for months in response to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's proposed overhaul of the Israeli judiciary. In recent years, Netanyahu has faced indictment in three corruption cases. Many believe his 2020 trial and legal woes are connected to his attempt to dismantle the judiciary because the overhaul would also allow his far-right government to overturn Supreme Court decisions. Like Trump, Netanyahu has tried to cast his indictment as political persecution by a radical left. Over in South Korea, which has only been a democracy for 36 years, four recent presidents have been criminally investigated and two have been imprisoned. Those prosecutions have not eroded the country's democracy, the Washington Post writes. On the contrary, despite being home to a political scene as angrily polarized as the United States, South Korea has managed to weather the storms over corrupt former presidents and maintain peaceful democratic order as power shifted from right to left and back. Americans would do well to pay attention, end quote. In France, former President Nicolas Sarkozy was convicted twice on corruption charges. His predecessor, Jacques Chirac, was convicted in 2011 of various crimes, including embezzlement and abuse of public trust. In both cases, the Washington Post notes that the court system was able to weather accusations of political bias because it was transparent. Over in Italy, former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has been accused of bribery, tax fraud, and witness intimidation. He was convicted of tax fraud in 2013. Berlusconi, the billionaire magnate who now sits in the Senate, even had to perform a year of community service for that conviction. Joining me now is Asha Rangappa. She is a senior lecturer and assistant dean at the Yale Jackson School of Global Affairs. She's also a former FBI special agent with the Counterintelligence Division and the editor of Just Security. Asha, good to see you. Thank you for being with us. This is a really, really, really important point of context. Prosecuting current and former politicians and leaders does not actually destroy your democracy. In some of these examples we've seen, it strengthens it.
Yes, it feels counterintuitive because we do tend to associate, prosecuting former leaders as being associated with banana republics. But actually, a study that was done by Axios found that since 2000, 78 former leaders in 78 countries have been jailed or prosecuted. And since 1980, about half the countries in the world have had such a case. Ironically, monarchies and dictatorships are the places that are least likely to have former leaders prosecuted and jailed. You know, and I think the former part is really important, Ali, because we definitely have obstacles in holding sitting presidents to account because of the vast immunities and privileges that that office holds. But I think that we are definitely outliers when that person becomes an ordinary citizen. We have chosen to not take those steps until now.
It is interesting, though, there's a flip side to this, and that is those places in which a government comes in and then weaponizes that government against former leaders, where I think Donald Trump would like us to think that's what's going on here. There are instances in the world in which that happens.
Absolutely. And I think this is where process is so important. Process, process, process. There are certain key features that we need to look to see whether those are legitimate prosecutions. Are there robust protections for the defendant that allows them to present a vigorous defense? Is there independence between law enforcement and the ruling party? Is there an independent judiciary that can be fair and impartial? And I think all of those key features will determine whether, you know, this is some kind of rogue, politically motivated type of prosecution or one that is done in accordance with the rule of law. And I think that here we really do have a robust and impartial judicial system. And I think Trump will be entitled to present his defense and have a day in court, and he may even be acquitted.
Let's talk about this particular case, because there were certain people involved in the payment of money to Stormy Daniels. There was Stormy Daniels. There was Michael Cohen. There was David Pecker from the publisher of the National Enquirer. Alan Weisselberg may have had some involvement in this, because they say that nothing happened with Trump's money without Weisselberg involved. And of course, there's Donald Trump. One of the things Donald Trump has tried to do, not with Weisselberg and not with Pecker, but with Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen, is to undermine them, to target witnesses, to make their credibility, to make them seem less credible in the eyes of the public. I don't know if that's going to work with a jury.
Well, I think we need to distinguish between the court of public opinion and the court of law. Trump plays fast and loose in the court of public opinion, and he is not going to be able to do that in a court of law. And we saw that last week when he had the opportunity to present a witness to the grand jury. He presented his former lawyer, Robert Costello, who tried to undermine Michael Cohen. I think the version that was presented was that Stormy Daniels approached Michael Cohen and, I think, you know, sort of engaged in some kind of shakedown, and that Trump had nothing to do with this. Michael Cohen did this on his own to respond to her request. And the facts are that this was being done as a part of a larger arrangement with the National Enquirer to bury stories that were potentially damaging to Donald Trump before the election. And it was David Pecker who forwarded Stormy Daniels to Cohen. Those are the facts, you know, and you're not going to be able to spin in a court of law the way that you can in public. And I think he's going to have a much more challenging time there.
There's an interesting spin that came from the Washington Journal's editorial board response to the indictment the other day. That the Wall Street Journal said, once a former president and current candidate is indicted, some local Republican prosecutor will look to make a name for himself by doing the same to a Democrat. Now, in response to that, you tweeted, you said, once again, this is so disingenuous. This isn't some local prosecutor like some rando. It's the prosecutor of the city where Trump resided and did business for over half a century. Tell me more about this.
Yes. You know, we all subject ourselves to the jurisdictions of the states we live in. We agree we're going to pay taxes, that we're going to follow the rules. The vast majority of law and the vast majority of criminal law is at the state level. And states are separate sovereigns than the federal government. They have their own interests to vindicate. And if a crime has been committed in the state of New York by someone who was living there, who was earning money, who was doing business there, then they are entitled to charge that person for the crime. You know, this isn't some prosecutor in Idaho that's just decided to bring a case against Donald Trump. And again, we get back to process. The Manhattan DA had to present evidence to a grand jury showing that there was probable cause that a crime was committed before this indictment could issue. It's not something that he could just decide to do on his own. And I think that that hurdle, and on top of that, the hurdle to prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt,
right,
is what makes this you know, a legitimate prosecution.
There's an actual trial that has to come. Donald Trump is entitled to the protections every American citizen has. He is not, he is innocent unless and until proven guilty in a court. Asha, good to see you. Thank you for being with us. Asha Rangappa is a senior lecturer and assistant dean at Yale Jackson School of Global Affairs and a former FBI special agent. That does it for me. Thank you for watching. Catch me back here tomorrow morning, normal time, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern. I'll also be hosting special coverage of the indictment of the former president, Donald Trump, tomorrow night, starting at 6 p.m. Eastern. I'm joined by my colleagues, Simone Sanders, Katie Fang, Jonathan Capehart, and the Reverend Al Sharpton.
Welcome back to Money Mania, where we're talking tax season and what to do with that refund. If you really want your tax refund to have a positive impact, I'm bullish on Ohio's 529 plan. I always say, invest in something you love. Well, there's nothing we love more than our kids. So invest in their future and let your tax refund help. For as little as $25, you can get started today at collegeadvantage.com.